Best Moments episode of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudelli sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudelli.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Futures Radio Show, where we will highlight our favorite moments of the show over the past month. But before we get started, I want to thank all of our sponsors: CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. So without further ado, let's dial into those top moments of the show this month.
So I'm glad you brought that up in terms of execution. You know, I know a lot of analysts, right? Fundamental guys, technical, economic guys, all across the board. And everything's very theoretical, you know, traditionally from the analyst community. Everything's like, well, in theory, then this should happen. But there's very little talk about risk management when it comes to analysts' research, right? So I think that I am lucky because I had no interest in being an analyst. I came from the trading side, right? So for me, I always looked at the market analysis from the perspective of the person trying to execute a thesis. So I look at it completely different than the analyst, right? So yeah, sure, people pay me for my analytics. So technically, I'm a technical analyst, but I am always aware of the fact that none of that matters. The only thing that matters is the execution, right? We're not here to be right. We're here to make money. And those are two completely different things. And analysts don't care about making money. They just want to be right. And they'll keep pounding the table all the way down to zero. And they'll be like, oh, well, we got it wrong.
Are we on the verge of another emerging market crisis?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the answer for sure. But what I can tell you is that when the Fed tightened rates a great deal in 1994, one of the first things that happened was the Mexican peso collapsed versus the US dollar at the end of 1994. And the Fed kept policy pretty tight throughout the rest of the 1990s. And we had a succession of currency crises, beginning with the Asian currency crisis in July of 1997, the Russian currency crisis in August of 1998. And it sort of culminated with Turkey and Argentina seeing their currencies devalued around 2000, 2001. So now that the Fed is tightening again, you have this problem where there's so many emerging markets that have gotten so accustomed to 0% financing from the Federal Reserve that supports these enormous carry trades. You know, a lot of these emerging market currencies like the real or the ruble have 10% plus interest rates. So as the Fed tightens, that currency carry trade starts to diminish a little bit. And so you run the same risk that you see with the treasury market in Italy. You know, you have a crowded position and somebody liquidates and it causes a cascade of these sorts of trades liquidating, which in turn causes the emerging market countries, like in the case of Turkey, to raise interest rates a great deal to defend their currency, which in turn harms their economy. It doesn't always end up supporting the currency as the central bank might intend. So I think that the jury is still out, but I think that as the Fed tightens, the risk of a generalized emerging market crisis begins to rise.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I will definitely be keeping an eye on and seeing you write about it. And a final thought for today, I want to talk about oil. Boy, what's going on in this oil market? You know, one of my favorite trades, I talk about this a lot to people, is that I like to find a market in a primary trend, wait for a major pullback near daily moving averages and support coinciding. That recently happened in oil. I turned around, took a couple of longs, stopped me out. And you're sitting there going, oh, we go from going straight up in oil to now are we going straight back down? I don't know what's going on a technical basis. I'm still watching. But talk to us about what you're seeing in the oil market.
You know, when it comes to the technicals, I have to admit, I'm kind of lost as well. I look at the technicals. I don't know where it's going from that perspective. But what I can tell you, though, is from an economic perspective, things are pretty bearish on oil. You have OPEC, which is now starting to think about readjusting their agreement to cut production. Saudi Arabia and Russia are pretty happy now with the price of oil. Maybe they'll like to increase production a little bit. You have soaring U.S. production that's hitting record high week after week after week, thanks to the fracking going on in the United States. You also have a lot of other headwinds. You still have pretty high levels of inventory. They're about 20% off their highs, but they're still substantially higher than their sort of historical norms. And then lastly, you have more and more efficient vehicles providing this constant headwind for demand. When it comes to upside risks on oil, and I do think there are very important upside risks, I think those are really political risks. So economic risks are to the downside, but you have these political risks to the upside, the end of the Iran agreement, potential tensions within countries, within Saudi Arabia, within Venezuela, that could disrupt production. But unless you actually see a disruption of production in one of these countries, it might be difficult for oil to sustain a rally.
Okay, I want to move on and talk about Venezuela a little bit, because this was something I recently learned on an interview here on Futures Radio Show, and it was an interesting stat that Venezuela actually sits on more oil than Saudi Arabia. I didn't know that, but and then we were talking about how they are cutting production. How could Venezuela, who sits on more oil than Saudi Arabia, have issues with production? Talk to us about what's happening in Venezuela.
The situation in Venezuela is just, it's so, so sad. I every time I write about it, I just feel for this place so much. So essentially, Venezuela had a lot of oil. I think it had about 80 billion barrels in its proved reserves by like 2005. And then once we saw the development of these new techniques, particularly some of the techniques in fracking and in oil sands, they began to basically say, oh, here's all this oil, now we can actually put into production, so we can convert it from, say, like probable or possible reserves to proved reserves. And so by the end of 2010, they had, I think they listed their proved reserves at about 297 billion barrels, which is higher than Saudi Arabia, which says that they have 260 billion barrels of proved reserves. Now, keep in mind that these are self-reported numbers. So, you know, we do have to take it a little bit, you know, with a grain of salt, because we haven't seen any real numbers. These countries don't share their numbers, although Saudi Arabia may share their numbers soon. So part of the reason that Venezuela is having such an issue is that its oil is expensive to produce, not just because it's difficult to produce that oil, but also because of the way their company runs and their country and things like that. So they really needed higher oil prices. But essentially what happened is you get this weird combination of the fact that their oil industry is very expensive. The oil is very expensive to produce. They relied on hydroelectric power for electricity, and they had a horrible drought. So when you combine that, terrible for the population. And they don't have enough electricity in these places to really produce that oil. Then you've got a socialist state that had all sorts of other industry, but then essentially expropriated it and put all the money that it used to put into, say, agriculture and manufacturing, put it all into developing the oil industry, which was great when oil was $100 a barrel and everyone was saying, oh, Venezuela is such a model socialist state. But when oil drops to $40 a barrel, they're in huge trouble. And their oil industry was not particularly well run. It's not a very well-run company, and they can't afford to pay the workers who are out in the oil fields. They can't afford to keep the lights on. They can't afford to keep pumps running, and they can't afford to pump that oil. So Venezuela's production has been steadily dropping over time. I think their allocation for OPEC right now is, I think, 1.97 million barrels a day. So it's below 2 million barrels a day. They really, I think, would probably want to be producing up. They can produce over two, and it's just been dropping. I think in April they were recorded by, I think Platts said that they produced only 1.41 million barrels a day, which is incredibly low.
So compare that to other countries in production. How big of an impact is that going to have on the oil market?
I really think that this is the real story of the oil market. So everyone said back, you know, when Ali al-Naimi refused to cut production, and everyone said, oh, it's the Saudis versus the shale, and the Saudis are trying to kill shale. I don't think the Saudis were trying to kill anything, but what they did do with their all-out production and basically cutting prices was that they killed Venezuela's oil industry. They didn't necessarily kill shale or kill other things, but they definitely killed Venezuela's oil industry. And this is really, I think, the story of where – this is where – and part of the reason why OPEC has been so successful with its production cuts. Part of it is Saudi Arabia did cut more voluntarily, but Venezuela's production has just dropped off. Angola is another country whose production has also dropped off, and that has made OPEC very successful in reducing the inventory overhang.
I want to talk about something that you and I were talking about a little bit last night at the opening ceremony. We were in a conversation and I said, you know what, Karina, a lot of people that I've been speaking with here in London and the UK have been saying to me, you know what, Anthony, there no longer can be a soft Brexit. And you said, well, I don't know about that, Anthony. So here we are today at FIA recording. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, of course, my comments first, let know my personal views. It's, I'm by nature very optimistic. I think with regards to Brexit, a lot of cards are still on the table. I think there is certainly a desire, and it's a wish by the financial industry as well. They benefit most from a soft Brexit, which means actually being part of the single market and the customs union. We do not know where this is getting to, but in terms of soft Brexit, there are also equivalence rules giving access. But I think we will see also in the Brexit negotiation potentially a trade deal. That will also, there will be something on financial services, that's clear. How much that is, we do not know. But at the minute, I think it's, there is a significant amount of uncertainty. So we just did a Brexit survey. Our head of Europe, Simon Poulton-Jones, conducting this with a lot of our board members, I think with the entirety of our board members. And I think one of the significant concerns that came out of this is the uncertainty that still hangs actually over financial markets. Personally, I'm actually quite surprised how well markets are still doing with the surrounding uncertainty. But I think that's also what Stephanie Flunder is this morning at IDX from Bloomberg, that there seem to be some independence now from markets actually to politics actually. So that is quite an interesting development. We saw that in Germany too when there was actually no government in place. Actually, the economy was doing exceptionally well. So. But I think this uncertainty surrounding Brexit negotiation is not a good factor for the industry, and there needs to be clarity. And the industry is calling for clarity for a significant amount of time now.
I understand that FIA has now opened an office in Brussels. Is that a result of Brexit?
So, as I mentioned earlier, it is. So in the past. So as I said, we had actually been traveling back and forwards, me and colleagues. We've met the Commission and we constantly had interaction with Commission, Parliament and Council, also other European citizens, actually not only Brussels. We see policymakers in Berlin, we see them in Paris and Frankfurt. But yes, absolutely, it's a desire of our members to be there, that FIA is there permanently. We are a global trade association and it's Brussels going to be... it's going to be in the future the decision maker and for European markets, with the UK potentially or quite clearly actually losing its influence. So yeah, it's a decision, and as I told you as well, policymakers, the comments I receive, it's the global influence that we bring into the debate is with some policymakers actually a desired outcome.
So I want to pick your brain a little bit and get your thoughts on the core issues and concerns around Brexit.
Oh, there are plenty. It's the uncertainty, as we discussed earlier. So there, it's again as well about market access, both sides. So UK EU players access to the UK and the other way around. We have a significantly important CCPs in the United Kingdom. So it's, yeah, about access as well. And then also the future relationship that is going. So there is already firms are working on their contingency planning, executing them. So moving as well already, catering for hard Brexit. So that is what firms are doing, catering for that in terms of contingency planning. But there is also wait and see, I understand. In some firms, there's a bit of wait and see and reluctantly actually executing all of that. Brexit is a significant, there is significant complexity behind. We have not seen, so it's basically rewinding 40 years of common rulemaking, and that has to be a significant exercise.
Now, I know you said you're an optimist, and I know that from just meeting you. I could tell you're a very optimistic person, but talk to us straight here, and how do you see this all panning out?
So I think what is clear, and what we hear from policymakers on both sides, the United Kingdom, London is going to remain a financial center, that is certain, because there, London is such an attractive place actually to be. But yeah, we will see actually business move as well. It's also quite clear if there is, the UK wants to have a very enhanced free trade agreement. Europe at the minute doesn't say that they can deliver that. So we have to wait and see. This is a political decision. This is how it's panning out then in the negotiation between policymakers. But there will be life after Brexit. So absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, life always finds a way, right? It's not going to stop anything. So,
and we know as well, I mean, that's what policymakers also think in Brussels. It is actually from all areas, it's the financial markets that adjust most easily because it's very innovative and they're used to being innovative. It's other areas that they were actually much more about than financial services. It's moving goods and things like that.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. That's what's going to be tricky.
Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account. Okay, so there's one thing I want to talk about when I hear people say, you know, they use fib retracements. Are you using the basic ones that are, what's the 38 back, halfway back, 618 back? And also, how do you know when to trade which one? I mean, to me, it sounds like you are looking for things on multiple time frames to coincide, and that's how you choose them. It sounds to me like you're using a lot of confirmation, because when I hear people that are using fib retracements, I'm always wondering, do you just buy every retracement or sell every retracement? How are you refining it to say, okay, these are the ones that I want to take versus these are the ones I don't want to take?
Yeah, I'm definitely refining it, because that's one of the reasons why I'm looking for the confluence of the price relationships. So, for example, a single retracement of a prior swing, I'm not really interested in. But if it coordinates with, you know, a couple of other price relationships and I have the minimum of three, I will focus on that. Also, if I have a symmetrical projection from, you know, three points on the chart, if that overlaps other price relationships, I'll focus on that. And then the other way to refine the entries is, you know, to use a trigger, which is essentially the price action that tells you that it's worth placing a bet against the zone. And typically I'll go to a lower time frame chart to find that. So for example, the chart that I'm going to send you where I described that cluster in the S&P, let's say that you would go down to a 30-minute chart and wait for the 30-minute chart to trigger an entry via a moving average crossover, for example. And then that tells you that it's worth placing a bet against that zone, because otherwise, you know, what do? You're going to buy the 382 and then get stopped out there, buy the 50%, get stopped out there. No, I don't do it that way. I look for the confluence and I look for triggers that tell me that it's worth placing a bet.
So Jay, could you tell us a little bit more about TT Score? Could you tell us who this is for and who this is benefiting?
Right. It can be all the way from a single trader on a TT platform all the way up to a exchange or a federal regulator, because it's scalable. So if you're trading on a TT platform and you are interested to see whether or not you may be engaging in behavior that would potentially draw regulatory attention. That's what our score is going to tell you. So even if you're not intentionally doing something that may draw the attention of the regulator, if it's similar to things that have drawn regulatory attention in the past, you can see that you're going to get your scores and you're going to know right away that maybe you need to review what it is that you're doing, because you may be getting an inquiry letter here soon. But then above that, you can also have compliance officers using it at proprietary trading firms, at FCMs, and then also at exchanges. You know, we're talking to several different exchanges that are looking to, you know, go to more innovative technology with machine learning as opposed to your traditional legacy-based surveillances, because we do a better job of handling big data sets, and that's what they're dealing with. And we want to create efficiencies with our approach, and that's what we're best at. And then also with regulatory bodies, again, we're talking about people that are responsible for supervising, you know, the entire futures industry. And that's a massive job. And having better technology to streamline that work and make you more effective at it, is that's what our goal is to provide to people.
So Jay, just to be clear, you don't have to be trading on TT to be able to look at TT Score. Anyone can look at and use TT Score.
Yes, that's correct, Anthony. So you can take trade data from any front end that you're using, any endpoint, be it a third party ISV or you know, any kind of proprietary front end, and basically, we take all that data and we compile it all for you. You can view it all on TT Score, and it's actually going to be saved, and you can access that data at any point as well.
How are you working with your traders and helping them decide whether they should be completely discretionary? Are some of them using some automation, or maybe just looking at a trader saying, hey, maybe you should be going fully automated? Is there any in between with you, or is it purely one way?
It depends on the on the individual, but I've got a fellow that works for me. He's a quant, and we quite often butt heads on certain things. And you know, I learned quite a lot from his angle of his thoughts, and he's quite regularly surprised that I can see the patterns that I see. But it sounds to me like yourself and myself, like we're a very, very solid abstract thought process, and which is essentially pattern recognition. And whenever I've dealt or work with pure quants, they don't like to understand that there's something that they don't understand. So, you know, and the best guys I've worked with, he hated Fibonacci. Apparently it was disproven years ago, and I said, but it doesn't matter whether it was disproven. If enough people watch it, then it matters. So, you know, it really comes down to the fact that I think the best methodology would be a degree of combination of both. Some of the smartest people that I've met have become the worst traders. So they almost need like a trader to oversee them in a way. So I'm really sort of pushing my guys towards being more team orientated and trying to feel the best of both worlds as best they can, because I don't think we're increasingly becoming a world where one man can't take on the market anywhere near as efficiently as they used to be able to do.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.